Okay.
English and to Johnny Vetmore. Johnny, I'm sorry, I have to apologize once more that we kept you waiting, but I don't know if you've been able to follow this. I don't know if you've seen or heard the English translation of this interview. Are you with us?
Yeah. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah. We can hear you.
Hello. Perfect. Right. Hello. How are you? I did try and take in as much, but I did only hear it in German. And my German is nicht gut. But it does exist to a certain extent. It was actually quite a meditative process to listen to another language while I was like, of course, you're a bit nervous when you come onto something like this. So it's quite a nice, he's got a lovely voice. He's very expressive. It's very nice. I did pick up on certain things. I did understand really what you were kind of talking about, because the same words kept coming up again, such as control, which I think is one of the major issues with what we're dealing with here, is that a lot of people can only see the pandemic side of it, or the fight between what we do at the time. But this is a wider control structure going up around us, has been going up around us in many different ways, from many different angles. But this is very definable process. So I was interested in that last graphic. That was very interesting. And I think this is a time where we just get to see graphs over and over again. Yeah. I did hear you mention Vera Sharav.
Yeah.
And as she mentioned, one of my articles I did last year on your program, and that's that came to my attention last year, because I wrote an article called Schwab Family Values, which is about the ancestry of Klaus Schwab. And that one moment, to be perfectly honest, in the past few years has really given me a boost as well, because I take her opinion very highly. So I love the work you guys are doing, and I understand a little bit of it, but I have my most recent article, obviously, I'm happy to speak about in full, but I'm also happy to speak about anything to do with this agenda. And I'm happy to come back on again. I try to investigate in a different way than most people. What I do is I look for the parts that everybody else is missing. Now, that's pretty easy when you look at if you compare it to the mainstream media, what they do is basically distract you over here and miss out all of the information. So in actual fact, a lot of people think, how do I get into journalism? Well, there's loads of stories there to be told. No one's telling them. And what is really important is understanding what are the important stories to tell, especially during a time like this. So I work for I'm independent as a journalist. I'm on johnnyvedmore.com, but I also work with Whitney Webb on Unlimited Hangout. We've done a lot of investigations. Of course, she's done so much fantastic work on exposing higher control structures that are usually implemented by intelligence agencies, shadowy organizations and trusts, things that are dislocated and disconnected from the governments that are supposedly in power, which I think we're all aware that the World Economic Forum's reach, seeing as their young global leaders are people like the young global leaders who took power eventually from the World Economic Forum, are such people as Putin, Trudeau, Macron, usual suspects. Even Blair, I believe, might have been a world economic young global leader. So there's obviously a globalist agenda to this. And so it makes it really complicated with COVID-19 and coronavirus in general. It's made it really complicated to work out where the power lies, because it's global. It's the actual situation is global, but there is a way to define how the power is dealt out and who deals out the power. And that's really what I wanted to do in my most recent article, which is I'd been put onto a man called Jeremy Farrar, who's the head of the Wellcome Trust. Brief history. The Wellcome Trust was set up after the death of Henry Wellcome, who was a pioneer in medicine. He basically invented things like tablets and stuff, you know, he normalized the use of modern medicine, made lots of money, of course. His trust became very powerful. Up until the mid-90s, it had a private arm called Wellcome PLC, which was heavily involved in pharmaceuticals, and an American arm called Burroughs Wellcome. They were the people who were behind AZT, which is the very controversial response to the AIDS drugs. Change in the mid-90s, around 94, Glaxo and Wellcome merged. So Glaxo was came along and bought up Wellcome PLC. And then following that, they also then bought Smith, Kline, Beecham. And they were to merge all of these companies together, and from it would come three or four separate entities. So I hope you're following me here, and I'm being as clear as possible. GlaxoSmithKline was born from this. And the person who manufactured this merger and created GlaxoSmithKline, Beecham's, and the Wellcome Trust as it was today, because Wellcome PLC was dispersed and let go into the ether of the pharmaceutical industry and bought up by Glaxo itself and merged in with them, where the Wellcome Trust was set up as a separate entity. And Richard Sykes states recently that in 1997, he merged the he started on a project of merging government, academia, and the pharmaceutical industry together so that they could all have the aim of sharing research that they would see as, of course, of beneficial to each of the companies, but their selling point beneficial to the whole of humanity because we're all sharing information. And this would give them, though, certain powers of control on research, on grants. It would make them the center of the British research industry, really. Most of the papers, scientific papers that you'll see written by people like Oxford and Imperial College, tend to have Wellcome Trust money attached to it. And it's not small amounts of money. You know, this is a very powerful foundation. It's seen as a philanthropic foundation rather than any entity within the pharmaceutical industry. But obviously, during COVID, they've exposed themselves as having quite a wider reach. So in the mid-90s, Wellcome Trust was born. And the man who made this merger, Richard Sykes, who was the head of Glaxo, GlaxoSmithKline, he would recruit a man called Roy Anderson. And Roy Anderson is a professor of epidemiology, but he's also the man who pioneered modern computer modeling. And the first time computer models were introduced to the public in a way that allowed for the creation of a fear-based propaganda, really, a fear-based propaganda tools. Look how many could die with these graphs of our futuristic and hypothetical predictions. That was pioneered by Roy Anderson and Neil Ferguson during the time in the early 2000, so 2000, 2001, when the foot and mouth disease crisis happened in the UK.
How did Neil Ferguson enter the picture?
Neil Ferguson was already the apprentice of Roy Anderson. Uh-huh. So Roy Anderson brought up Neil Ferguson. He was his professor and his teacher. Neil Ferguson went to, when he was trying to work out what he was going to do, he went to a presentation by a man called Sir Robert May. Sir Robert May is a close friend with Roy Anderson. They've co-authored two books together. And he's also the guy who I believe recruited Roy Anderson. I think he's a level above Roy Anderson in this kind of control structure that emanates from the Wellcome Trust, which I've been able to identify and detail to some degree, and it's ongoing because there's so much information. Robert May, he used to be the president of the Royal Society. He's got many links. Of course, he was heavily involved with Wellcome Trust. He introduced Niall Ferguson to the idea of computer modeling, going down that route. And at that presentation, he decided, that's my route. I'm going to go and be taught at the Lineker school in Oxford, where Roy Anderson at the time was the Lineker professor. So the Lineker professor is a very established role from 1860. It's a very, important place in Oxford as a teacher. And Niall Ferguson became Roy Anderson's apprentice, really. Roy Anderson was his mentor and his professor, and they would be almost inseparable. Now, Roy Anderson had issues eventually at Oxford as the Lineker professor there of zoology. That's the full title. He would make comments about Sunetra Gupta, who worked there at the time, who later went on to be involved in the Great Barrington Declaration. And at the time was married to Adrian Hill, who went on to front the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine. So, I mean, it's all very interesting. It's like a little soap opera, you could say, going on there. Roy Anderson said some bad things about Sunetra Gupta that weren't true. He refused to take them back. Then he was forced to have to make this like half-hearted retraction. It didn't go down well. The board, the board at Oxford kicked him out. He took his whole team, which was all funded by the Wellcome Trust and included 70 researchers, across to Imperial College London. That was in 2000. And this is very interesting and very important, because they would, when they changed over to Imperial College, and they take all of this funding and they spite Oxford publicly, they would also start to research and put all of their team's focus into foot and mouth disease. And foot and mouth disease hadn't been an issue in Britain, and there hadn't been an outbreak since, like for 30 years. It was the late 60s that the previous outbreak had been. So it made no sense. The only previous animal to human transmission they were looking at before that they were studying was BSE, and that doesn't really work in the same way in spreading. It's from infected meat rather than from spread from human to human. So they suddenly, months and months and months before, changed their, about 4 or 5 months, I think, changed their whole focus onto foot and mouth disease. And then foot and mouth disease suddenly happened just before the elections in the UK in 2001. And when it started, of course, the narrative was, oh, look, it's come from this one farm, this guy who we're going to scapegoat for the whole thing. But it was discovered all over Britain. So it'd obviously been going for a while. Foot and mouth disease, cattle don't run around like humans, you know, they don't spread the disease like humans. But it is very, very spreadable. And there's a lot to this, because Tony Blair at the time, he was coming up to the elections, and he had called his election for May, and foot and mouth disease had broken out, and it was obviously a bad PR moment for an election. So he wanted to push it off. The advisors for foot and mouth were saying, we need to do vaccination rings. The official advisors who were with him were saying, we need to do vaccination rings around infected areas, where you start vaccinating from, say, 5 miles out, and then you work your way inwards, or 3 miles out, and you work your way inwards. Culling any infected animals, and that's usually the most effective way to prevent the spread of foot and mouth disease, and to control the virus and to get it to eradicate it, really, because that is possible. Vaccines, in this case, the foot and mouth disease vaccines, there have been many tests done on them. There have been many experiments. They were relatively safe. There was no human issues about eating the meat from the vaccine. They seemed to be nothing, no problem with it. They could be a little bit ineffective at times, but it was probably the best route. Instead, Tony Blair was pushed by this graphic that got produced by Niall Ferguson and Roy Anderson, and they would also be on the advisory board, foot and mouth, by the government. They were suggested to be put on the advisory board, again, by one of Robert May, Sir Robert May's friend, Sir John Krebs, also up there in the Royal Society, son of Hans Adolf Krebs, who was ejected or ran away from Germany during the persecution in 1933. So he left, went to Britain, and then became a famous, very famous scientist doing very interesting. His son obviously got rewarded over time. He's also quite, he's a Sir John Krebs, and he's a member of the Royal Society too. I'm going off a track here. Anyway, Blair was obviously worried about the election. He put Roy Anderson and Neil Ferguson in charge of the entire response for foot and mouth disease. Against all of the other advisors, they said, we need to do a mass cull on a scale never seen before. And if we don't do this, these models will come to fruition. And this will be the worst thing that will ever happen to Britain. And no one will ever buy our meat again, et cetera, et cetera. And it was true fear porn all the time. At the same time, these men, Anderson especially, were put up to put down the foot and mouth disease vaccines as ineffective and not good to use, because you should instead do culling, which is obviously completely the reverse to how the tack they took in COVID. This whole period then turned into hell for farmers in Britain. And I can't describe the scenes, like some of the stories that you read about during this time. It was just, and a lot of land got bought up afterwards because a lot of farms went bust. So, I mean, it seemed to be this rolling agenda of getting rid of the menace to CO2 at the time, cattle, which were really seen as the main culprit of letting off sort of gases and et cetera, and methane. So they were the targets. They also got the chop, along with sheep, who weren't really affected by foot and mouth disease, and pigs, who were. It was burning pyres of millions of animals, 8 million animals slaughtered, and littered the countryside. I remember it very well. My 21st birthday, I wasn't able to go into the countryside because it was all blocked off and the police stopped us. So it's like, it was a point where they locked down society. So Roy Anderson, and to be clear, Roy Anderson and Neil Ferguson's tactics during foot and mouth was to take the harshest measures possible, lock down society as much as possible as they could with the fear that they could produce. What for? Well, the whole crisis was eventually manipulated through computer, through the statistics being produced and given out in different ways than they originally had produced and given out the statistics, just like in COVID. So the MAFF, the MAF, the Ministry of Agriculture, Fisheries and Farms, had previously been putting out all the statistics about the infected animals, the culls, the rate. But as it approached this election, obviously there was problems. So Tony Blair put the election date back to June or July, and Roy Anderson and Neil Ferguson changed the models to show that the virus, the foot and mouth disease, would finish by literally on the exact election date of Tony Blair. At the same time, all they did was speed up the cull and make it more intense. They kept that off the news completely, of course.
Was there a basis? Was there really foot and mouth disease, or was that an invention in itself?
Now, that is really interesting, because in Purbright Institute, which is one of the biological and chemical I would say weapons, but research facilities in Britain that's owned by the government and Porton Down, but Purbright especially had I think it was 500,000 samples of the 7 different types of foot and mouth disease there. And 6 years later, there would be an admitted leak from the lab when trees grew through the pipes in the lab, and foot and mouth got out again. That time they caught it really early. Now, the first time there was questions on whether it got out from the lab, but the destruction was so bad I don't think they wanted to take any, they wanted to admit it at all. There were articles that came out at the time questioning it. Of course, the fact that it's the Center for Foot and Mouth Disease Research and is extremely suspicious. And the lab leak later on, 6 years later, that was reviewed and then covered up by another one of these Wellcome Trust-funded people called Brian Spratt. They're all, this is all a very actual small group. For all of this, for the foot and mouth disease and for COVID, for there to be such a small group of people who are unaccountable, unelected, unattached to governments, shadowy, are able to take control of every single person. It should be something that really, really opens up people's eyes to the fact that there is obviously control structure going on. Now, purpose is something that is so impossible to verify. It's almost unfalsifiable unless it was the best whistleblower ever and or the best leak of information ever. I don't think we'll ever know of behavior of how they respond, and that's really what I'm focusing on, because at first I wanted to understand about the lab leak in Wuhan. That's where what I first looked into, because I was very interested in this proximal origin of SARS-CoV-2 paper. And the reason I started out on this was because
Could I just ask a quick question with regards to the foot and mouth disease? So what do you think was the point of this? Because, I mean, was this just about like re-election or was it
more to it?
Or like a training for like upcoming, pandemics of whatever kind?
I don't think it.
Did they sell a lot of vaccines later on?
I think that Tony Blair had no control or power over any of this. Uh-huh. And his input was minimal. He would just like brush it aside, say, okay, they're going to deal with that. The whole point of it, what it seems to be, is that constantly throughout the next 20 years, these men would produce the same devastating looking graphics to try and manufacture consent for other responses to virus outbreaks. So then they managed to actually, that wasn't like the first time that they had warned about viruses. That was the first time that they actually managed to say, look, there's evidence of a virus. And so that automatically means logically you should listen to us because we're the people who sort out viruses. Now, in the next 10 years, you would see them make predictions on bird flu that would be, say, 200 million would be dead when it was like around 574 eventually. Predictions on all forms of SARS. They were... over the past two decades, seemingly trying to spark an event, a fear-based event. But the problem for them is, unless the actual hysteria starts around a virus and the virus actually manages to look like a real threat, it's impossible for them to then road from there to COVID. That they were, it was the same people trying to get this point where they can lock down society to do certain things. Now, with that period of time, you gotta remember this 2000-2001, and that was an extremely interesting time in history, and there was a lot to distract attention from. And so if they wanted to do a dry run for something and they wanted to see what the whole what their control structures were like, foot and mouth disease was one of the least scary viruses for humans, because humans weren't likely to be affected. So humans would say, oh, well, let patients would say, okay, there's an epidemic all over the place. They're telling us we need to do this. We should just listen. That should be very different when it comes down to human virus or human bacterial infection or something.
Well, there's two levels.
But I think that this...
Johnny, I was going to say there's two levels on which this is playing out, the foot and mouth disease, which obviously helped Tony Blair. His, well, I guess they everybody must have thought that this is a very professional reaction from him, and it must have helped him win the election. But there's two levels at which we mm-hmm. have to look at what these five people were doing, these Wellcome Trust people were doing. One is, was there really a leak? Maybe there wasn't. But if there was, then this is even worse than I thought. But even without this being a leak, the idea of culling 8 million animals, I mean, that tells you something about these people, because they know nothing about the disease. They are just working on computer models. I mean, maybe what's his name, Roy something, maybe he knows a little bit about such diseases because he's a zoologist, right? He's not a veterinarian.
Yeah.
But it tells me, if you look at these people, this is just one part of the picture. There's the Wellcome Trust, and the other really important healthcare trust is, of course, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, both of which had played a huge role when they had another such rehearsal in Germany in May of 2019. They were there. Drosten was there. Tedros was there. And Wheeler, the German equivalent to the to Fauci, was there. But if you look at the people, and that's what you're doing, you're looking at those people those very few people who behind the scenes seem to be running the show. How can you kill 8 million animals? I mean, I don't care if it's animals or people. This is terrible.
Yeah. And I think it comes down to, all my research every time, it unfortunately ends up in the same place when I look into these people. They tend to pay great attention to things like Malthusian ideology. So the idea that the population is out of control and the resources, well, we could all live a better life and a healthier life and all have so much more if there were less people on Earth. Because basically the resources and people are always kind of like in flux, is what Thomas Malthus once said. That's the basic ideology of it. I think they are a part of what is really like a modern humanist tint to it, or agenda to it, where it's the idea that we need to get rid of a large amount of the human population. That is the only thing that it keeps coming back to. And that's why, for me, when I was researching this, you know, I didn't start off in researching the foot and mouth disease. I'm telling you this like a chronological sort of trying to keep it chronological. But when I first started looking into this article, it was really just about the effect of the cover-up taken away all of the responsibility of the main actors who have then responded to enact this control structure nowadays. I didn't expect to find this point of, oh, they were also the people who had the burning pyres of dead bodies all around my country, because I'm not a very nationalist person, but that was a horrible moment in history. There's one little story that kind of shows, because what people don't understand as well is that when these things get enacted, they become standard operating procedures. They become put into writing, and people just act regardless of emotion on their job. They have a job to do, and they will do it nearly all of the time. When enough pressure is applied, 90% of the time, they will just, you know about the Milgram experiments, etc. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, that's in a setting where it's like there's not so much pressure involved. As soon as you apply pressure, it goes from being a 60% of people will comply and just continue to electrocute someone, to 90% of people will continue to do that. You know, people given enough pressure in society, given enough fear, will do a lot of terrible things. And I do believe that a lot of these people have a feeling that they're above everybody else. I can't understand them a lot of the time. I can't understand why they do what they do. All I try and do is like document the evidence. At the end of any article, I try and give a tiny little bit of opinion. And when I wrote my first draft of this, man, I was so angry. I was so angry because these people, after foot and mouth disease disaster, and that got covered up by there being an inquest put in. The inquest, instead of being just about foot and mouth disease, which would have then put Anderson and Ferguson central stage, got split up into three different sections, and they fell right between the gaps. So there's three different inquests set up on three different parts, and it allowed them to get away with any responsibility. In actual fact, in 2000, Ferguson was given an OBE, which is Order of the British Empire. It is one of the honours given in New Year's by the Queen. So these guys weren't punished or weren't rejected, even though all of the people, like Dr. Kitching, who was one of the advisors at the time, and had to resign over it because he was disgusted by how much a small group of unelected people who didn't seem to understand the virus suddenly got in control and changed the entirety of society based on false science and false data, because that's what it was. And that made me so angry. So when I wrote the first draft of this article, I was almost like Robespierre. I was there with a pitchfork ready to mark, but it's more important than that, because the thing is, with my work, it can be very emotional at times, because you get connected to you're going through events that affect everybody around you, so you get connected to the actual things, the actual story or the actual article, the information involved. But this one, when I looked further, every time I looked a little bit further, when I started looking at proximal origin and I looked at the people who were involved, and then realized, you know, well, a lot of these guys are really heavily Wellcome Trust funded. And then I find this Holmes character and Rambo character and Anderson and Sykes, and eventually you can easily see who the people who are the main actors are, because they're nearly always connected in these situations that are high up. What I see are little units that they're put there to do the job and delegate the tasks. And they're usually a very small unit. They have to be. And they usually have to be well connected, not only to the establishment in general and the government in some way, or the establishment that's maybe more behind the scenes and shadowy, but they also have to be connected to each other. They have to be, like, for this to work, for these control structures to work, you have to find, often you will find, and I think you'll find this in separate countries where I'm looking, I'm trying to identify what's happening in Britain, but it has massive global connotations, the actual actions of these small group of British men. I think that's interesting as well. One thing that I should know, I do believe this Wellcome Trust gang, it's not just a UK control structure for these events. It's not something that they've just pulled out here. It's also being used by the Americans, and that's why they were given the job of covering up the lab leak in Wuhan, and where COVID actually originated from, or where COVID actually originated from. Because I mean, I'm still open to any information that comes in that proves where and what actually happened. But the people who covered up this paper, they're all very close friends, and they have to be to trust people, to trust each other. You cannot trust people who are not your close friends, and you will see this repeated over and over again. These small group of close friends who are really, really, and colleagues who are really, really heavily responsible in delegating to a wider group underneath them, and then so on and so forth down the lines until it trickles down into society.
How did this start? You explained about the merger and how this merger
became GlaxoSmithKline. On the other hand, Wellcome, which was one of the most powerful sources, one of the most powerful pharmaceutical producers, I guess you could call them, before the merger, it disappeared more or less. It turned into the Wellcome Trust, which then became, next to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, one of the two most powerful healthcare funds in the world. So, who is responsible? Yeah, that's what I thought. I was just going to ask that. Who is responsible for this decision? For the decision to create the Wellcome Trust and give it the, and include the, what did you call them? The Wellcome Trust gang. Because they're not, I don't think they invented this. It must have been someone else who told them to do what they're supposed to do. I also doubt, but this is a different story, that we're really talking about friendship. I mean, what kind of friendship must that be?
Yeah. Well, of course. I mean, I'm pretty positive that a dinner party around these guys' houses wouldn't be the most fun occasion around. And it would be them talking about things that are probably unrelated to the control and power that they're, you know, they wouldn't be sitting around cackling, we're all doing so well. In all this, there is one major link that obviously I come to in the conclusion, but it's not the only, it's a complicated infrastructure. It's a complicated environment. Firstly, all of these people are heavily connected or fellows of the Royal Society. And the Royal Society is a very small group set up many years ago, had very historic members such as Albert Einstein and Isaac Newton. And it is a place where all of the sirs and lords of the science world go to connect with each other. And they're often given the responsibility by the House of Lords to write reviews and papers on things that could cause controversy. They're also heavily involved with connecting. It's like a bit of a social networking group, in a sense, for that. A more illustrious scientists of society. Some of the international members include Elon Musk, and people who are really big on the stage. And I'm not suggesting that this Royal Society is some sort of massive round table group or something along those lines. I do think that it contains a lot of committees and groups inside it who are delegated certain tasks by the government that the government themselves cannot handle. So with foot and mouth disease, it was coming up to election. The government don't want to be heading up this. They go to Kreb and May, and they say, you need to build a team to help us out with this. Go on.
So is this, how do you get admitted to this Royal Society? Do you get elected, or like someone has to suggest you?
You do good things for them, and then they give you a place. I mean, that's really what it is.
That's how it works. That explains everything.
Yeah. What's interesting, like, Roy Anderson, Roy Anderson works for the British Ministry of Defence in like the noughties, and then goes and is on the panel for some science panel for Bill and Melinda Gates, one of the major ones, and a lot of those organisations. I mean, he has got, if you look at the list of titles and honours and awards and etc. that he's got, it's just insane. No one human can. I think he's the governor of the Institute of Government. I mean, the titles like that are just Orwellian in their way. To be admitted into this society, you have to have someone who's vouching for you. But I think you also, and you have to be selected in some way, but I think you have to be down with the cause. And the agenda is, listen, we are the Royal Society, and the Royal Society's in charge, and we're really in charge. You know, we're the ones who, they feel like that. They're not, but they're one of the many groups who have a certain amount of control and power and believe that they have enough sway and love to influence things, because a lot of these guys are retired. They're not really doing big scientists, etc., used to have really busy lives. Now they all have executive positions that they don't even have to attend to. So I think a lot of it is like old men having activities after they stop being part of the establishment. Mm-hmm. And so, what the Royal Society is a very useful tool for governments, for the UK government to say, okay, we need a job done. So in my opinion, with the proximal origin paper, and what all the evidence I think points to, is that the Americans had done some form of research in Wuhan that went wrong, and they needed people to come in and say, okay, this didn't come from a lab, and they didn't want to get Americans to do that, because if you get Americans to do that, then you're just like, oh, look, you've got your agency to do it. Instead, they decided, let's go to the people who will have the most trust. And this is a lot about what these people, and I can talk about this a little bit later if you want, but the creation of this idea of trust. So in America, they're very stereotypical with the way they view royal British people. They're like, oh, they're all so charming, you know, that sort of like, they're dazzled by them. And I think they have that simplistic view that, oh, if we get the Royal Society and their guys, or we get the British, they'll get the Royal Society to sort it out in some way, shape or form, through committee groups and through their little shadowy sort of meetings and appointing the right person to this and appointing the right person to that. All of them who have connections and influence, all of them who wander the same corridors. I think that that's the easiest way for the Americans to say, okay, that's nothing to do with us. See, we didn't cover that up. Well, we didn't do it, so we're not responsible for it. Sorry, go on.
I was just wondering, do you think this is also the source of this, the narrative of the, you know, this, the social engineering part of it, like coming up with these terms of like social distancing and, you know, flattening the curve, and, okay, you know, because someone must have written the script.
This is where I was going to get to when I was just saying this is very important with the idea of trust, because I wrote another article called Edelman PR and the Manufacturing of Trust, yeah, on Unlimited Hangout. And basically, Edelman PR represent around 70% of all world's business, all world's governments, including parties on both sides. Many of the private people who are high up, they represent nearly 70% of them. Every year they have a trust barometer where they talk to the World Economic Forum members about what the people trust and what they don't trust, and they've been doing that for 20 years. Edelman PR was originally set up by a guy called Daniel J. Edelman, I think his name is Daniel J. Edelman, and he was American PSYOPs during World War II, so psychological operations against the Germans. He eventually went on to set up a PR firm that basically represented people like Colonel Sanders of KFC brand, and other famous people. They built the biggest PR firm in the world. His son Richard Edelman would take over, and Richard Edelman would join as the right hand of Klaus Schwab at the World Economic Forum. And basically, the majority of the lines you're hearing out there, from the Great Reset, Build Back Better, Flatten the Curve, all of that comes from Edelman. Every single thing. You can trace every single thing back to Edelman PR and its representatives. And Edelman PR, go on.
Sorry, I didn't want to. No, just you finish it.
I was going to just say that Edelman PR, I mean, the first time I ever heard their name was when there was a Jeremy Corbyn coup, a political coup in the UK, where they were trying to kick him out as being leader of the Labour Party, because obviously he doesn't fit in with the globalist lines and the normal agenda that they want. So they needed to push him out. And all of the people who were the front of the coup, Chuka Amuna and people like that, half of them got jobs with Edelman PR afterwards. But they do the job and they get the job with Edelman PR, and that means they're set for life. they're done. Yeah, they can be sent round to do anything. The AWMPR is so big, so completely and utterly powerful. And one interesting thing, which I think is really important to this, is that in 2016, around 2016, I think it was, that Edelman's Trust Barometer focused in on one thing. It was about 2015. It was just before Trump. They said at that time that 80% of the populations of the world now don't trust media, the mainstream media, and that they call them fake news. And they said, we need to redefine what fake news is. We need to stop the media from being seen as fake news, as currently is. And we need to battle our best to use reallocate that term to use against the people who we want to, who want to create this different world that we're not in control of, you know, the different media or independent media. And then from that point on, you've seen the turn of fake news from what was originally a term used about the mainstream media and their manipulation of narratives and their constant lying and their constant corruption, really, and bias. All of these people were just simply they get called something and then they rebrand it so that you're that. You know, it's like, it's petty. It's like in schools.
It's astroturfing. I think that's what it's called. It's astroturfing.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Yeah. But I don't think they're going to get away with it because quite obviously more and more people, even and in particular those who got the shots and then realized, oops, we may have made a mistake. Even those people are not looking for real information at their places. They're not looking at the mainstream media anymore because they understand that is why they fell victim to what happened to them.
Well, this is very interesting as well, because what happened after that whole push for the trust to reframe fake news is that the trust in the mainstream media went back to about 60%. The reason why they were so worried about it being 80% of people mistrust the mainstream media was because that was the first time the mainstream media had become the most distrusted out of the, they have like four categories, and mainstream media was the first time it had become the most distrusted. They managed to get that down to 60% mistrust by the time they were doing they were starting this agenda. Now it's back down to 80% mistrust. So they know they're dying. They know they're dying. Yes. They're a dying breed. They do not do their job at all. And it's good. It's good in some respect for people like me who are then able to just have loads of stories. We've got all the stories we can tell. We've got the evidence over here. No one's covering the most important things of the current generation. I mean, it may be very good for people like me at the moment, even though we're censored all the time. There's an agenda.
Of course.
Yeah. And how were you able to trace all these Orwellian terms to Edelman?
Edelman's was extremely interesting because he's so they're so open about what they talk about. So when they rebrand, when they use these terms, they will tell you they're using these terms. We just don't watch their presentations. If you go over to the World Economic Forum, the Trust Barometer does every year, or if you look for their videos, the Trust Barometer is every year, and it goes on for, I think, a couple of days, and they have loads of presentations about all of these different things. And all of these terms, like Build Back Better, etc., they come through this machine, this World Economic Forum machine that comes out once Edelman has said, okay, we've done the testing, we've tested on all of these different people. When it comes down to things, when I hear things like flatten the curve, it's really easy for them to find something like that because already there's loads of terms being used and they're behind the scenes doing just like, I can't remember what you call it, sampling people's response to these terms. And they've got a massive operation. I mean, it's enormous. Their ability to understand what works with people is the reason why we're in this state at the moment. So what we hear now, you will be able to hear Edelman PR say first on one of their trust barometer presentations or one of their many articles, Richard Edelman prints articles all the time. The thing is about these guys is they're very open about their agenda. And then when you tell people who don't know anything about their agenda, people say, oh, that's a conspiracy. And you say, well, look what they say. And they say, really? It's a complete surprise to a lot of people that it's just so blatantly obvious and they're saying it to our face.
Yeah,
but Edelman is not doing this by themselves or for their own fun. I mean, someone must be there. Someone must pay them.
Well, they're the top of the PR chain. They're the top dogs in the PR chain. Their payment is keeping that market share, not being attacked by other. Because what they're currently, their situation is fundamentally negative for governments all around the world, for people, for companies anyway, because they represent both sides and they're just twisting words and manipulating things. As soon as they're held to account on that, the obvious question would be, well, why are you so big and why are you allowed to be so big and such a big monopoly and et cetera? But that's why they've been supported so much. That's why people go to them, because they are the future propaganda, world propaganda, they are being set up to be, and they have already been set up to be the messengers of the message that they want to send to people.
So it's the Ministry of Truth, basically.
It is the Ministry completely. Set up in 2000, the Edelman Trust Barometer, and every year you watch, each of the years you watch extremely interesting things they say that really, they're almost meta, because they're saying stuff where someone like me is like, well, I'm trying to tell people you're saying that and they're not even listening to me. So, I mean, it's beyond understanding how much control and power they have.
But haven't they run into a real problem now? I mean, it in my view, at least. Of course, they all have a plan B and C and D and whatever, but their corona narrative is definitely crumbling. It is falling apart. I think they've lost control over it. And the worst of this is that two things. So many people are waking up to this. So many people seem to be understanding because of corona, because they just went way too far. They're so blatantly lying that even some of the most naive people are beginning to realize something is not right. So that is problem number one. Problem number two is that they're following the people who they've been addressing and who've been believing in all that crap that they've been telling. They're killing them. I mean, precisely the people who have invented this this plandemic are killing their own followers. So what we're going to end up with is 20%, 30% of the population, more in the United States, more in other parts of the world, but here in Europe, between 20 and 30%, who will not go along with this and who will not even listen to them anymore because they have come on to them. And the other 70 or 80% or whatever, they're going to be dead or at least gravely injured.
Every single authoritarian, totalitarian regime, every single effort to try and control the world's population will come undone eventually. These guys are full of what you could say hubris. They're full of false self-confidence. They believe that they have the power because they've been told they have the power. A lot of the same way that the people who believe that the vaccine is good for them have been told the vaccine's good for them. That's all they're basing their ideas on. They really do believe that they're untouchable. And every time in history that we see these people to get to this stage of control, negative control, and push down on the population, we see it end. And people don't, when we're caught up in it, no one realizes it's going to end. It can't keep going like this. These guys are not the future. These guys who want to change our biology, who want to take us to the future in space, these guys would create a future and a world which would be worse than what we're seeing now. And we all know it. We all know it. Even the public knows it. And at the moment, we're seeing a breakdown of democracy, partially because it's been attacked from all angles, from people such as the World Economic Forum, with the idea of stakeholders. The capitalism being a better alternative to democracy, where but in reality, democracy is almost gone. It's almost gone. It's such a puppeteered system. It's a racket. It's a load of what we would say an old boys network. You know, it's a load of old friends who are all just trying to. I can't say it any better than rape the world and rape the finances and rape everything they possibly can and abuse everything they possibly can because they're quite unhappy people and they aren't able to ever concentrate on themselves and their own development because they're too busy being these people who are so malevolent and having all these issues and troubles all over the place. These guys always burn out and we've got to have faith and we've got to have confidence that this is no different. And everybody, when they go through something at the time, feels like it's different and everything else in the past. But I've been following this agenda of control and with the use of virus and bacteriological infections. I've now gone back 130 years to where I can really see the beginning of these countries realizing, not only realizing, but enacting chemical and biological weapons programs and developing them for the idea to kill as many people as possible. And that's never changed. That's not changed. And that's another thing people don't realize now. People are too busy right now going, but we've had that before. We learned from it. So it won't happen again. And at the same time, we can watch people be murdered all around us. All around us. And it just makes no sense. And it's absurd to people who are logical. It's absurd to people like us who have some sort of ethic and moral understanding of what it is to be human. But to these other people, I think I don't want to be someone who others somebody because that's what they do. That's how they separate us. You know, they make us someone else. They other us all of the time. But I do see them as other. I can't help to see them as other. And what's really interesting is if the worst of these guys actually got what they want and got rid of, say, 90% of the world's population, do you know who would be left? Them. And the people who are their adversaries.
Yeah.
The middle people, the people, they see them as cattle and their actions would see them disposed of as cattle eventually. That's the most malevolent of them. I'm not saying that's the general people who are on the wards or enacting these policies even, because a lot of them are doing it out of what they think is goodness and what they've been told is goodness. But if these people really got what they wanted, there'd be 10% of the people living on Earth than there is now. And it would be us versus them all the way, and they would have all the power.
That's the point.
So we are the adversaries.
We will be the ones left because everyone else has fallen victim to them. Yeah,
it's amazing that it works out like that as well. You'd think that if they fought it through a little bit better, that they wouldn't end up with like an exact amount of people who hate them on at the end of it. You know, you'd think that we'd be the first they target, but I think they've realized that they've just got to keep bashing away at the populations.
Yeah.
They got to keep, if they keep doing that, and they're going to reach their agenda eventually. But that's, that's an idea that a lot of people just would never let happen and would fight against in many ways. I think we're seeing it, and I think their agenda is falling apart. It's almost pleasant to watch, but it's really sad because it's affected so many people in such a, it's such a wide array of parts of their lives.
They're fighting illusionary battles which they can't win, and that's why they can't win the war, because ultimately, as you're saying, we're going to be the ones left.
Yeah,
and they can't deal with us.
And can I ask you, from like following their work, can you already see which agenda they're going to hype next?
Ah,
climate crisis. We have concrete evidence, by the way, just to jump in there, from the Middle East. Very fresh evidence that they're closing wells there because, and this is another panic motive, I suppose, because little children fall into these wells. There's no evidence that that's really happening, using this in order to close the wells so that ultimately the people will be dependent on someone else selling them bottled water instead of having their own water. And they're promoting artificial meat. And we know who produces that. Bill Gates is one of the producers. So that may be the next craze. Because this is killing our environment. There's too many people breathing.
Yes. Yeah. And I had this conversation an hour ago or an hour and a half ago with someone in the park. I was walking my doggy around there and she was telling me it doesn't matter. This all COVID stuff doesn't matter because we're going into global warming. And I had to tell her, well, now they've changed the line about global warming. They call it climate change now because it's not actually warming. It's like they're talking about maybe a global dimming even. And, you know, people react to, that person has had that belief for 10 years, 20 years. It's really hard to tell them something different. It's really hard to show them any evidence and for them to really like accept it because they have built a lot of their ideas about wider society on the basis that there's too many humans and we're all doing bad things all the time. On that point, and that's really important as well, if you go back to 1973 and the third of the World Economic Forum meetings, this is something that I talk about in Schwab Family Values. They talk about this agenda openly. The Club of Rome representative who does a speech during that time at the World Economic Forum talks about Malthus, talks about the idea of population control and talks about using climate change, that that's the future, using the idea of climate change to control the world's population and eventually get rid of a load of people and population control. And that is a recorded speech. It's there. It's documented in history. Really worth reading because it really, I think, showed very early on their true nature, the true nature of the society, which was to start using this. So I think it's going to be one of the tools in the toolkit. I mean, we're seeing things like Ukraine and Russia. Again, Putin's was a World Economic Forum young global leader, and probably the Ukrainian prime minister was probably a World Economic global leader. You know, it's become a point where it's just buffer for the mainstream media to pump fear into the environment. And I'm not sure if anything really is going to happen that bad. But yeah, climate change and this sort of thing. I do feel that the major next step, what we see coming, is going to be this whole cyber hacking attack on the infrastructure of society, on on transportation, on transporting of goods. They've laid down the ground for there being a cyber pandemic. And this has been the thing that they've been slowly growing over during the COVID time. While everybody else is talking about coronavirus, the World Economic Forum moved on nearly straight away and started talking about the cyber pandemic to come. Now, they've got very interesting cyber polygons, something I've written about. That's the World Economic Forum, along with Russia and many other actors, including Americans, who all come together for this cyber defense simulation. At the same time, they're all meant to be enemies. I mean, the whole thing is a real, it's a weak puppet show if you see enough of it. Yeah. If you watch the show over and over again, you see all the strings, but most people don't get to watch the show over and over again.
Well, this time I think many more people are watching than they ever expected. And they're not looking in that direction anymore where the pandemic is. They're looking in all kinds of directions because they want to find out what is really going on.
Well, go on.
Johnny, I don't mean to be rude, but we have another guest who we need to talk to. But we will definitely have to talk to you again, because I want to know about the family values of the Schwab family.
I would love to speak about it, and thank you for having me on and let me give my evidence. I feel it as a relief, and thank you for all your work.
Thank you very much. This was very enlightening again.
Yeah. Okay, good. Wow. I'm happy to speak at any time.
And say hi to Whitney when you talk to her.
I will do. I'll tell her. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Yep.